As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Knut Jakobsen, who is at the University of Bergen in Norway. We are, of course, talking about his fascinating new book, Yoga in Modern Hinduism. Hello, Knut. How are you doing today?
Very fine, thank you.
So how did you stumble upon writing this book?
I think I have to go back to 1990, because in 1990 I came to Benares to study with Ramchankar Bhattacharya. I was by that time a student at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and I worked with Jerry Larson, and he had worked with Ramchankar Bhattacharya, and he recommended that I contact him. He wanted his students to work with the pandits to kind of learn how they dealt with texts, because we were told that we should learn not only how kind of Indologists dealt with Sanskrit texts, but also what it meant, these texts meant in contemporary India. And then I met Ramchankar Bhattacharya, and in a way, I was told that I had a view that he was a traditional pandit who was a specialist in Sankhya. And but then he gave me some texts from this Kapilmat, written by the guru, especially his guru, Dharma Megha Aranya. So I discovered that he, in a way, was in connection with a living Sankhya Yoga group. And then I spent almost 2 years in Benares up to March 1996. And then a few months later, Ramchankar Bhattacharya died. So then I was, of course, I was very fond of him. So that was it was a very sorrowful event. So I was thinking what to do. And I think one way to deal with it was to go to Kapilmat in Madhopur. About which I knew very little, I had been given these books. Also, as I write in the book, a catechism of Sankhya Yoga, which I found really fascinating. And so I was very curious about this institution. And then I went there in 99, maybe January or late 1998. And then I got started to think that I would write about them. It was not a very easy group to research, because the Kapilmat institution in Madhopur were visited by very few people. And in the beginning, I didn't know quite how things were organized there. For instance, the institution that the guru is locked into in a cave, and he meets the people only 5 days, the first 5 days in the Bengali month. So except for those 5 days, there are hardly any people there. So visits had to be timed, etc. So then the book, in a way, grew from those that interest in what a living Sankhya Yoga tradition would be like, because it was something unique. I think maybe the only living Sankhya Yoga tradition, and then with a very unclear origin. I mean, where did it come from? Yeah. I mean, I was very surprised. So was this an ancient tradition, or was it a modern tradition? What kind of tradition was this?
So obviously you've stumbled upon this a fascinating discovery, and maybe to underscore for some of our listeners, you've stumbled upon a living Sankhya Yoga mutt. So maybe you can unpack the novelty of this discovery for those who may not be as steeped in Hinduism as folks like you and I. Why, if you were in some sort of a Christian country and you stumbled upon a monastery, right? This is a very different kind of situation than just stumbling upon a monastic tradition of ancient India. Why is this a unique phenomenon?
I think the uniqueness is that we think about Sankhya as an ancient tradition and not a living tradition. And this kind of the Sankhya textual tradition, I mean, it flourished a few hundred years in ancient India, and it, with Yukti Deepika, maybe 8th, 9th century, the last kind of classical text, then it, in a way, had a revival in maybe 14th, 15th century, but then again, not a dominating school at all. The Indologists, also in the Indian Indologists, like Rajendra Mitra, looking for pandits who worked on Sankhya, didn't find anyone. So it was, in a way, as a pandit tradition, also not a living tradition in the 19th century. The second point is that, with Jain and Buddhist traditions, there are a lot of archaeological remains. There are a lot of texts telling what these monks were doing in the past, but what a Sankhyan, the Sankhyans were doing is not, I mean, there are no descriptions of their practices. So that was, I saw here a possibility to see what were Sankhyans doing. I mean, you had both lay followers and sannyasins. So what would that be like?
So Sankhya is one of the six orthodox classical philosophical schools of ancient India. And there are others that are much more common in living tradition. Would you say this is the, to our knowledge, only living Sankhya school?
No, there have been other modern gurus who have called themselves Sankhyans. But I would say this is the only monastic tradition of, how should I say this, who follow some sort of Sankhya orthodoxy. I think that's the correct thing to say.
So you've stumbled upon this this mutt where folks are adhering to some sort of orthodox Sankhya ideal. So the book is called Yoga in Modern Hinduism. What does yoga have to do with Sankhya?
All right. So yoga in this connection means the yoga of the Yoga Sutra and the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. That is yoga as one of the six philosophical systems. Now that is quite different from, it's a very small part of what we call yoga. But in modern India, this text of yoga was in a way revived and had an enormous impact on the modern, the global yoga movement. This was the text that Vivekananda chose to translate. And when he was asked to give lectures on yoga in the United States, he chose the Yoga Sutra as the source of yoga. The source of one source of yoga philosophy. But this text, the Yoga Sutra, and its auto-commentary, the Vyasa Bhasha or Yoga Bhasha, is a Sankhya text. So there are, in a way, two schools of Sankhya. One is the Sankhya school of the Sankhya Karika, and the other is the Sankhya Yoga school of the Yoga Sutra and the commentary tradition on that text. So this Sankhya movement believed that the founder of Sankhya, Kapil Muni, Kapila, was also the founder of yoga, because it's the same philosophy, according to them. And Sankhya is the theory part. Yoga, Patanjali Yoga Shastra, is the practice part. When we think about the six darshanas, Sankhya and yoga are often paired. So it's well known that their philosophy, the yoga philosophy is a sort of Sankhya philosophy. But with the popularity of this text, and also because it was joined with Vedanta for some centuries, it has many different interpretations. And in most environment, it's interpreted almost like a Vedanta text, I think.
So tell us about some of your experiences at the Kapil Mutt, in terms of the representation of this ancient living Sankhya yogin tradition.
Yes, it's... Hariharana the Aranya, who was the founder of this movement, he was a very good Sanskritist, and he also was very well aware that the Patanjali Yoga Shastra was a Sankhya text. So that was his main idea, in a way, that Sankhya and yoga are two aspects of the same philosophy. Members of this mat, the lay persons, they are very loyal to the Sankhya philosophy, and I think have a feeling that this Sankhya philosophy has not been, in a way, recognized as a major Indian philosophy, as it should have been in the kind of living Indian Hindu environment. Now, there is something I should say about the context of this Kapil Mutt, is that Madhupur was, why Madhupur? It's a small city. It was in Bengal presidency, then in Bihar, and now in Jharkhand. But in the early 20th century, it was a place where the kind of upper caste elite Calcutta people did have second homes, that is, homes that they used for holidays. So very many of the devotees are from those families who met Hariharananda Aranya because the family had houses there. So this was kind of an elite population called the Badralok. I don't know. So this was kind of an elite part of the Calcutta environment. So many of the followers in Madhopur are from that type of background. So I was curious what did it mean for these people to be Sankhya yogins? What did they do? For instance, if you go to modern yoga, it will be asanas and pranayam, and it will be taught in classes. So what was yoga for them? It was one of my, this is also important then, this yoga movement started before the creation of kind of the modern global yoga. So there is no asana, no pranayam. It's ethics, yama niyama, and then samadhi meditation. They also distinguish very clearly with what yoga is for a sannyasin and what yoga is for lay people. As the sannyasin can aim for kaivalya, but for lay people, that is impossible. So their main practice when they are at Kapilmat, and also that is to be practiced at home, is actually the recitation, melodious recitation of Sanskrit slokas about Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga, composed by Hari Harananda Aranya. So for 45 minutes in the morning, they recite these slokas by heart, and the same with a little bit shorter in the evening. And I think these are intellectuals. I think they just couldn't just sit 45 minutes and say a mantra. So instead they have memorized then these very complicated Sanskrit slokas about Sankhya teachings, which they then recite, sing together. They preferable at home, they should recite them alone. So because aloneness is a very big thing for this Kapilmat tradition.
So there's a number of fascinating things that you've just said. Maybe we can unpack them a little bit. So in terms of what we can call the eight limbs of classical yoga, as understood now, especially in the modern West, maybe you can mention the eight limbs and underscore that this tradition relies upon really the first two and the last. So then for our audience, talk about the eight limbs of yoga.
So yama niyama are kind of ethical kind of preparations. It has to do with the behavior and exterior things like ahimsa, speaking the truth, celibacy. And then comes asana and pranayam, which is kind of body practices and breathing practices, which are, and especially asanas, that's body practices, is the dominating element in modern globalized yoga, pranayam to a certain degree also. And after that, kind of a control of the senses, pratyahara. And then the three last, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, which are about the concentration of the mind. So they emphasize then yama niyama, that is ethical practices, and then mental concentration. And how do they justify that they don't practice asana and pranayam? Then they say that, I mean, because of the samskaras, that is your previous lives, if you are attracted to Sankhya yoga, it means that in a previous life you have already perfected asana and pranayam. So that if you are kind of attracted to Sankhya yoga, mental meditation, it means that you are already beyond this bodily practices. I think also this movement will be very critical of these other parts of yoga. And I write in a book, this Hari Arananda Aranya, he wrote a kind of a fictional autobiography. And in that, he criticizes almost every other type of yoga. I mean, he didn't find one honest sannyasin when he traveled around, not one honest yogin, and he hits in all directions. He hits at, without mentioning any specific groups, but he hits that in, I think, Ramakrishna Mission by saying that if people are interested in doing social service, do social service. You don't have to be a sannyasin to do social service. And then other types. So he had a very, in a way, gloomy view of the sannyasin phenomena, which kind of was typical, I think, for the Bhadralok culture at that time.
So just a short quip, it's his writings about him, his own life are a combination of hagiography and an autobiography. So maybe an auto-hagiography would be a good term. Yeah. But it's understandable that insofar as he is aiming to garner and to solidify interest and justification for his path as valid, he will necessarily critique the others.
He was very young when he wrote it. So.
Yes, a hot-headed yogi. Now this is an important point. This a very important point. I think this tension between the path for the renouncers who are aspiring after Kaivalya and the path for the householders, and the different praxis given to each. This is a tension, in my view, that's really at the heart of Indian religion. And could you say a little bit about that tension and how it's either reconciled or sidestepped in this path?
Yes, the guru, who is then a sannyasin, he is locked permanently into a cave. So that role is in a way taken to some extreme, that it's even a permanent physical separation with the lay people. His daily life is totally private. He cannot be observed, whatever he does. And so the difference between lay people at least the guru here is enormous. And at this time, there are no other sannyasins. I mean, there were some others before. But the lay people can, the idea here is that Sankhya Yoga is a very difficult path and it takes many lifetimes. Let's say Hari Harananda Aranya, I think believed that he had practiced Sankhya Yoga in previous life, maybe also in ancient India. And then his samskaras, his practices from that time, could be reactualized in the present time. So that in a way, practices are not lost, but samskaras are very, it's a big job to change them because they are habits. So that's looked at as a kind of a slow process. So if you are a Sankhya lay person in this life, you change a bit. But so then maybe next life you will be a sannyasin or maybe not. But it's not considered it's not wrong to be a lay person at all. Because you have other responsibilities, but then you change a little bit.
Is this path geared primarily towards laity?
Yeah, I think maybe, it is a unique tradition in that sense that you had a guru who was then, I mean, you have a lineage of gurus now, the third in the lineage. And certainly for the first two, they were, I think, maybe their goal was attainment of Kaivalya, and they were also admired for that. Very few people would want to become sannyasins, so that they do admire those who choose that kind of life. and also with a very strict kind of lifestyle of the Kapil Mat. I think they have told me that some persons come, some sannyasins come, and they stay for a while, but then they leave because not very much is going on. They often want a more social context. That in a way, often the sadhu life is very social, even if their ideal is solitude. Many of them don't in a way practice it. But here is a movement that actually practice solitude. And that for some people that becomes in a way maybe too eventless. That's not maybe what they was after. I think maybe also that there are not that much teaching going on. So it's very much movement that focus on the guru and the relationship, the meeting with the guru, those 5 days in the month when he is available in the window of the cave. So then I sometimes felt that it was like a kind of a large family. That's it's a kind of a break from city life. Most of them live in Durgapur and Kolkata. So Madhupur is countryside. So it's a way to get, that's Sankhya Yoga for them, is being those few days in Madhupur, away from work, away from city life, meeting other persons that they have met for very many years. Maybe their parents were also friends and followers of the same guru.
So a spiritual retreat center, in a sense.
Yeah.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You mentioned a bit earlier that the prescription for the laity on this path is the recitation of Sanskrit mantra. Stotrams that were actually composed by Hariharanana. Can you say more about this or how folks related to this? Was it acceptable that he actually composed? Did you get the sense that those verses had the same authority as verses in perhaps much more ancient and established texts? Or did you get the sense that this was... folks related to this in an insular way and understood that this was part of their guru's lineage. This fascinates me, right?
Yeah. I think sometimes I've thought about that. Sometimes we kind of think that, you know, there is this break with modernity. But I'm not sure if that's... I mean, Hariharanana, I don't think he thought that this was a break with modernity. I think he thought that he was in continuity with older tradition. I also found it fascinating. I think what defines actually being a lay devotee of in the Kapil Mat, or being a Sankhya Yoga devotee, is that you recite these mantras morning and evening. I mean, that's what makes you part of that community. And it's part of a kind of devotion to the guru and to the lineage of the gurus. And at the same time, an expression of the Sankhya Yoga teaching and an expression of an identity. It's in a way what builds this Sankhya Yoga community, what they have together. Because the emphasis is on aloneness, solitude, silence, but here, this they have in common.
So then who pursues, who undertakes the pursuit of this ideal? Who grapples with this philosophy? Where is that dimension in this path?
That's a good question. I mean, Ramchandra Bhattacharya, certainly, he did take a PhD at the university and study of the Puranas. He was both a scholar and a Sankhya yoga, and he dealt with this intellectually. Another person whom I write about in the book, he's started his own build his own monastery, ashram, temple, and started his own tradition. And some other of these sannyasin did write books. I think the first Brahmacharya, I think actually he's, after 20 years, he returned to lay life. There was, when I started this fieldwork, very long fieldwork, there was a monk, Ritta Prakash. So he was there for very many years, and I learned a lot from him, but he left the movement. There are only rumors why he left, so I don't mention anything about that in a book, and I will not mention anything here either. But so there are some sannyasins, there are a few people coming from new. Sometimes new devotees come. Some visit out of curiosity. A new phenomena is that some people from who had encountered yoga in, let's say, in one of the famous Mumbai schools or other schools, they come to visit, stay for 5 days. So there are, it's a very small movement, and people are very happy with that because they want to have a peaceful surroundings. They wouldn't want very many people to come.
So this Sambat Insular group of laity that engage in this mutt as a means of perhaps spiritual retreat. You have a chapter that talks about material religion. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think it'd be very insightful in terms of pointing to a real tension in this tradition. So the material religion, what have you found in your research?
Yes, the monastery is built in a certain style. This style has been repeated in other Kapil Mats or Kapil Ashrams also. Let's speak maybe of the Guru Parampara is important part of the material religion, that is Kapila as the admired first teacher, and then it goes directly to Hari Arananda Aranya from Kapila, and they have the Samadhi Sthanas. But then the teaching are also illustrated with statues and art. I think Bhaskara Aranya in Madhopur, he was interested in that. He had background in Shantiniketan, he had studied there. So he thought that would be a way to kind of to reach people with it, with the teaching. So they are illustrating, for instance, with a skull, which is, I think, some common among in some ashrams, which means that that's how life is going to end. So don't get attached to things that are not eternal in a way, things that do not survive death. And they are also, some of the teachings of Hari Arananda Aranya is also in statues. But the monastery in Sarnath, the Kapil Ashram there, has copied some sentences. So they have decorated the whole, the mat with some sentences from the Yoga Sutra and from Sankhya Karika. So, which is the kind of the key teaching, what one should remember then. And I think that's part of the, of the kind of the key teaching here. In the Yoga Sutra 215, I think it says that for the wise person, everything is suffering. So that is a key teaching in the Kapilma tradition, that that you shouldn't get... yes, that's... which is very close to the saying, the kind of the saying of the in the Buddhist tradition, and then the idea that the identity of the person, because it Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga has to do with who we really are, in a way that is it's a cultivation of a witness consciousness. Everything that can be observed of the witness by the witness consciousness is not our real identity, and that would be like thoughts, body, etc. So that everything connected to change is not the real identity, but the kind of the pure consciousness, the witness consciousness, is our real identity. So the practices has in a way to do with this cultivation of witness. Witness consciousness.
And so the practice, by the practice do you mean the recitation of these stotras? What are the see, the tension here is you have the symbol of the skull that represents, you know, the impermanence and eventual dissolution of all things, and yet this symbol was created. This is a material representation. For the impetus to denounce or transcend or wean yourself off of the material itself. And perhaps it's me, but I see a fascinating tension here in terms of in terms of drawing on this highly, you know, world-eschewing philosophy. The paragon, the exemplar of which is literally in a cave, and yet that renouncer, that one seeking Kaivalya, is the epicenter of folks in the world coming for their spiritual retreat, surrounded by material culture representing that ideal. And so this idea of the goal of Sankhya being a realization of Purusha, or seeing beyond the artificial senses of self. Who's engaged in that, really, in this tradition?
I think only the guru. And he is admired for being engaged in it. And that's part of his, of the admiration. And I think he kind of represents the truth of the teaching. The idea that he is practicing it is, in a way, a proof of the truth of Sankhya Yoga. And then they themselves try to kind of understand some of the teaching. They recite the mantras and then consider it a very difficult way. And that the philosophy is difficult is also part of the admiration. That, and especially, I asked once Bhaskara, I mean, difficult questions, and sometimes he would answer that he is a student of Hariharananda Aranya also. So Hariharananda Aranya is thought about as a really great thinker and a great philosopher. One who understood Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga, and then the current guru also looks up to him as so it's not a kind of an there is no easy fix. It is considered then a very a goal that is very hard to attain, and a part of the admiration of the guru is that he has taken on the practice to attain this goal.
Fascinating. And there's also this dimension of above and beyond reverence for one's preceptor. In this case, Hariharananda is understood to have attained samadhi. So he is liberated in this sense. And so he is such a one that is embodying what one is seeking, irrespective of being one's guru. This is someone who, at the end of their life, presumably, I've gleaned from your research that he's venerated as somebody who has succeeded in this quest.
I think so. Yeah.
There's a site, I believe. There's a site that is revered on the property in terms of where he had attained samadhi. Correct.
Yes, there is a samadhi stone which is behind the cave. So Dharma Mega Aranya and Hararanana Aranya, they have this, there's samadhi stanas, which is their bodily remains, in a way, are there also. So there are rituals around these samadhis. So they are venerated. Every morning you first venerate these two gurus, and then meet in the Kapilmat in the building and sing then the stotras, which also pay homage to these, the guru parampara and the teaching.
Would the veneration of the samadhi site, would it take on the idiom of bhakti, or what we consider as puja?
But very light puja, I would say. That is, a few people, not all, would light incense, and they would stand for a few seconds in veneration. So that would be the kind of the morning routine, that they go down to the Kapilmat, veneration in the samadhis, and then circumambulation also. It's a circular samadhi, and then they will go into the Kapil Ashram. So it has some bhakti quality to it, but very light, I would say, not very emotional. Some reverence, and then with the stotras. The stotras also state, you know, the wish to attain samadhi, the wish to attain freedom from rebirth, kaivalya, etc. So in the stotras, they also state what is the goal for everyone to attain. I think already Hararana and Aranya encounter this phenomenon that very few people were interested in it. So we thought it was because it was a very difficult philosophy. I think he would say that we shouldn't expect, you know, very many people to be very interested in the Sankhya Yoga path, that would be a natural thing. So it hasn't kind of been very interested in becoming popular, although I was surprised to read by Ram Shankar Bhattacharya that he had this expectation that the whole world should know about Kapila, because I think he was the first philosopher, the first person to discover that it was possible to get out of samsara. So therefore, I mean, Buddha was a disciple of this teaching, according to them. So Kapila is an immensely important figure for humanity, but he is kind of almost forgotten. So they are kind of aware of it, that this is an extremely important tradition, but very few people know about it. And it's natural that few people would be interested also. It's not the source of sorrow in any way. I think that is a good thing, because of peace and solitude are kind of the highest values. And it would be strange if a movement that preaches solitude would be enormously popular, maybe. And then if it was, it wouldn't generate a phenomenon where all, I mean, millions of people would go to one place to celebrate the idea of solitude, I would guess.
It is rather counterintuitive to spread the word of solitude. However, it seems that we're all sort of spreading the word of solitude in our social distancing at this time. So we obviously have very different methods and very different data. You're studying lived religious practice, and I study Sanskrit narrative. Mm. Let's see, what sort of pulled me into grad school for my master's was Rama and this bafflingly sage-like attitude towards his duty as a warrior, as a king. Mm. Right, that and that sort of that intrigue has never left me. But I, you know, one of the ideas that I like playing with is what I call the dharmic double helix, right? There are these two poles of Hinduism in terms of world affirmation and world denial, or I mean, nivritti and pravritti in terms of the Mahabharata. And here it is, here it is. Here you have this utterly idealistic, world-eschewing, isolationist path that is paradoxically, the isolation is the epicenter of this meeting place for interested spiritual aspiring community to have a congregation and sing together and revere this ideal together and like the strands of the double helix, they never meet, they never touch, but somehow they encircle each other to create this fabric, and that's one of the things that really fascinates me about this obscure but I feel important tradition that you've stumbled upon. What's it like today? What are the numbers like? Is it a thriving community today?
No, I wouldn't say so. And the current guru Bhaskara is more than 70 years old. There is no sannyasin, and the guru in the other, not in Sarnath, he died in 2012, and after that, it's a caretaker. There is a small community, because there is one important devotee there. But I'm also curious what will happen in the coming years.
So for the previous three teachers, this is the third teacher, correct?
Yes.
So for the previous two moments of succession, was it an existing student who succeeded in leading the mutt?
Yes, the second guru, Dharma Mega Aranya, was the son of the sister of Hari Arananda Aranya. He was his nephew, and he became devotee when he was very young. So when he was 19, I think he lived permanently in Triveni, where Hari Arananda was by then. And then the third guru, Bhaskara, is a relative of the person who gave the property to build the mutt in 1925-26. He kind of changed. He met Dharma Mega Aranya when Dharma Mega Aranya was ill, and he was asked bringing water and food. And then they started to talk, and then he was transformed. And that made him, he was actually a kind of a person interested in art and cricket and those things. But during those meetings, he was transformed. So he became then the third. So he became a sannyasin through those meetings. And then Dharma Mega Aranya died in 1985. So quite a few years passed by. I'm not sure. One would expect that there would have been a sannyasin. I mean, some sannyasin surrounding the guru, and that one of these sannyasin would be picked as a guru. As I see it now, there is no one person who, unless something happens, of course. very many of the devotees are children of, I mean, even if they are now 70 years old, it was their parents who were devotees of the first guru. So it's also a kind of family tradition. They do not attract that many new people, and also they wouldn't want to. It's not on their wish list in a way. They like the peacefulness of it. So it could happen that after this guru, it would be a caretaker, and then slowly it would. But it's very difficult to predict, because unpredictable things might happen.
Sure. I mean, barring the emergence of a qualified successor, and it seems that given the insularity of the community, given the age of the current guru, given the requisite number of years perhaps for proper training, that seems to be, let us bracket that off as not likely. So what are the options? Either once this current guru passes or attains samadhi, or however you want to frame that, the community will disband, or the community will unite around this ideal, not dissimilar from, for example, Self-Realization Fellowship is an example, where there was once a living guru. I think it was Paramahamsa Yogananda, correct? Just to use an example, a more popular example in the modern West, where there isn't a lineage of teachers. There is no, he had no disciple whom he authorized to carry out his word, but there's his living memory and a body of teachings. And so perhaps, you know, perhaps that may well be the fate of this group. But
yeah, that's
you see.
Yeah, I think very few. Very few groups do actually have a kind of a lineage of gurus. I think most gurus just is remembered. So it's kind of almost unusual that there were this lineage, also with this enormous criteria that the guru should be locked into a cave. I mean, that's so it's kind of a surprise, you could say, that it did survive almost 100 years with that tradition. Hariharananda Aranya locked himself into a cave in 1925, and we are almost, I mean, 2025 is not that long. So 100 years with that tradition, I think that's quite long. That should be considered a success, whatever happens next. I think things don't last forever anyway, so.
And then, certainly. And, is the cave a site of veneration?
Yeah, absolutely. So you could imagine that people, what happened in Sarnath when the guru died, that they will continue the rituals. I mean, the ritual singing of the stotras will go on. Maybe they will come there for these same 5 days, the first 5 days in the Bengali month, and for some time. So in a way, the tradition can continue. The books are there, the institution is there. So the question will be if new people will be interested in coming to the place.
What most struck you or surprised you about this research? What most stuck out as a takeaway that perhaps was either remarkable or that you didn't anticipate in some way?
I mean, what I I was very curious about this. Where did this teaching come from? There was a quote that is by Farquhar, who writes about, you know, that there are hardly any Sankhya and Yoga pandits left. But in 1912, as late as 1912, he met a Sankhya Yati, Hariharananda Arani, in Calcutta. So when Farquhar writes, as late as, he must have had the idea that this was, you know, something from the past that was, in a way, almost dying out. And he continues, he never met anyone from the yoga lineage, which means the Yoga Sutra there. And I read the quote many times, but then I realized that in the Kapilma tradition, it was also quoted first by Ramshankar Bhattacharya. He had an enormous memory, so he would quote by heart. But the text in his quote was a little bit different. He quoted Farquhar as saying, as early as 1912, I met Sankhya Yoga, which means that for Bhattacharya, this was not an ancient tradition, but it was something new that Hariharana and the Aranya brought about. So that's in the title Yoga in Modern India, that this clearly was a part of the modern revival of yoga. So I was very curious about, I mean, that was one conclusion I came to, even though other authors who have not researched this tradition in particular like to write that this is an kind of an ancient lineage. But clearly Sankhya does not have a continuous lineage. It has been created and revived and revived. And this is a revival. It's not, there was no oral tradition of Sankhya Yoga that Hariharananda encountered. He learned from a Sanskrit text. He was a very good Sanskritist. So he, in a way, stumbled upon this Yoga Sutra, the Vyasabhasa, and Tattva Vaisharadi by Vachasmati Mishra. So he studied this and in a cave then in Bihar for several years. And then he kind of, Kapilma tradition came out of that. His intellect working with a textual tradition and not the encounter of an oral tradition.
So would you say he was innovating, reviving in some way? How would you understand what he accomplished?
Yeah, I think he revived Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga philosophy as a living teaching. And I think that's my view also, that the Vyasabhasa, the Yoga Sutra, is a Sankhya text, and that he gave an interpretation in continuation with the classical schools, in a way restarted, at least as close as possible, an orthodox Sankhya and Sankhya Yoga tradition, which goes against very much of kind of modern interpretations, I would say. So he was able to kind of revive yoga as Sankhya. And if you think about the global yoga phenomena, yoga has become a big thing, but Sankhya has not been revived. It hasn't experienced the same revival, even though that is the philosophy of the Yoga Sutra and the Patanjali Yoga Shastra.
Another point of interest seems to be that despite the apparent absence of a lineage of Sankhya experts, or practitioners, nevertheless, Sankhya philosophy is the scaffolding of so much Indian thought. It's so pervasive. It's the spiritual, philosophical backdrop of yoga, but also everything from Ayurveda, Jyotisha, Hasta Samudrika. There's so many, many philosophical esoteric traditions that they don't explicitly exposit Sankhya philosophy because they implicitly take it as the way the world is. So the three gunas, this is just a pervasive idea. Vivekananda himself, for example, would have said, I think did say, that you know, his people need more rajas. Forget the sattva. You know, they need to be roused into action. And it's fascinating that this cosmology is so much a part of so many strands of Indian thought. Would you say?
And I think the devotees of Kapil Math will also say exactly the same. They are that Sankhya is the philosophy of India, and that it is behind so many aspects of Indian intellectual culture and So they would. That's how they think. Also, I agree, of course, that that's one of the fascinating aspects of Sankhya, that it's not only the Sankhya Karika and the kind of the technical philosophical tradition, but it's also a big part of intellectual history. And I think so there is kind of a if we should call it Sankhya culture, I'm not sure what exactly to call it, but it's something kind of a much broader and than the Sankhya Karika tradition, which is it's a very small philosophical tradition. So that's also some kind of a paradoxical thing, really.
Yes, it's paradoxical that it died out as a vibrant tradition in an acute sense, in an immediate sense, partially because it was absorbed, right, in a grander sense.
Yes. So here with Haridas Ananda Aranya, it's an attempt to kind of take it back. And I think maybe there have been attempts before also to kind of to take Sankhya back from the Vedanta, so back from and give it a kind of a Sankhya identity. And you can see this in the blog also.
It really begs the question, sort of to touch on the tension that we were talking about earlier, of for whom is Sankhya philosophy? I mean, you have a virtuoso like Hariharananda engaged in these austere practices to the extent to which the sadhus themselves find this much too isolationist for their liking, right? The sadhus themselves are not up to the task. And so for whom is this this austere philosophy? You really get a glimpse into the extent to which ascetic ideology was a tremendous threat to Vedic life and to Brahmanism, and that, well, if everyone's leaving the world to enter a cave, what would happen to society? Yeah. Is there anything in the book that you had hoped we touch on, or key takeaways or insights or stories, or, you know, is there anything else you wanted us to talk about?
I think we have touched on many aspects of it. And I mean, I'm aware that many of the chapters are very technical. So, I hope that we have been able to kind of present this as an interesting group, and that a little bit of a surprising as a historical phenomena that Sankhya Yoga it's also a living tradition. That is in the technical philosophy, in a technical philosophical sense. Then,
well, if we failed to present this in an accessible way, then the fault lies with your interviewer and host, not with you, since that's certainly my role to bridge the technical with the accessible. And I think we've avoided much of the minutia, and I've sought clarifications in terms where potentially needed. It's obviously a fascinating historical development that may well, you know, may well evaporate in the not too distant future or innovate, who knows. But I think this documentation of this tradition is obviously important for scholars of Hinduism, scholars of modern Hinduism in particular, and certainly folks who are interested in the philosophical background behind yoga, or in the West, asanas, I guess, is what folks call yoga in the West. There's one thing I had wanted to ask earlier, but I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought. And I find it fascinating. I wonder how this community would respond to this, the question of, well, you folks don't need pranayama and asana because you've had so many lives doing this, on the one hand. Yet on the other hand, you're such novices, you're going to sit and chant shlokas because you can't engage in any of the practices. There seems to be this, is it me or is this sort of talking out of both sides of the mouth here?
Oh, yeah. So it's clearly behind this is some tensions. And Ritta Prakash, who was the monk who was there for 15 years and left, he suggested to the guru that they should start teaching asanas, and because then more people would come. But the guru was, 100% against it, because it goes against the teaching of Hari Arananda Aranya and Dharma Mega Aranya. I think their argument against it would be that it gives too much attention to the body, and it leads to attachment to the body. So, it would be counterproductive for the attainment of the real goal.
From the perspective of Sankhya philosophy, it appears then that Hariharananda's words were prophetic for what's happening in the world at the moment, where there are certainly enormous physical health benefits to yogic postures, and there's certainly a tremendous attachment to how well we can do them, how we look when we're doing them, to the culture surrounding them, and what's lost is this salient idea that the point of the asanas, right, etymologically, is so you can sit. The point is so that you can take seat and engage in these last three limbs, whereby you're going inward. So really, really interesting. It's fascinating that somehow he, in that time, even sort of anticipated that folks may be distracted by the physical postures. A fascinating work. All right, so I think that's pretty much it, unless there's anything else you wanted to say before we sign off.
Thank you for the conversation. It was really interesting to talk with you.
Oh, you're welcome. It was interesting for me as well. I learned a great deal. Obviously, these interviews forced me to read much more than I normally would. So it's always a pleasure. So for those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Knut Jakobsen, who is a professor of religion at the University of Bergen in Norway. We've been speaking with him on his fascinating book, Yoga in Modern Hinduism. Until next time, keep reading. Bye-bye.